further ado, I'd like to introduce Kevin Jablonski, who's a local lawyer with Gray Beal Jackson, very competent, and he's going to give us what it says there. You can introduce yourself as well.
Sometimes we like to call ourselves attorney because it sounds better than lawyer. I don't know why. Anyway, I'm Kevin Jablonski, and I'm also a committee member here. And we've kind of got two different topics to talk about tonight. The first that we're going to deal with here is a few legal updates, if you will, about things that might affect our industry. I could probably put together two or three nights worth of topics on that sort of thing, but I've chosen three specific topics that we'll talk about. That will take us a little bit of time, not a lot, and I encourage any questions as we go through, and this is your chance to ask an attorney a question and not get any meaningful answer back whatsoever.
Or being charged.
Hence the reason you're not being charged. After that, we've got a panel of folks in the audio industry, and we're going to kind of conduct a little bit of a future think sort of panel and talk about where things might be going from a couple different perspectives. Some perspectives of what has the technology done, how are we using the technology, and perhaps how businesses have responded to that sort of technology and the advances that we're essentially all dealing with and learning to deal with. It's got some interesting repercussions that we'll see what we can figure out together. Again, that sort of thing, highly encouraged to participate with some questions, and we'll see what comes of it. So for now, though, three topics that I'd like to jump right into with respect to a legal update of sorts. Quick overview. In 2008, there was a thing passed called the Pro-IP Act. Talk a little bit about what are some of the ramifications of that legislation. There's also currently pending the Orphan Works Act. This hasn't been passed. It's been passed by the Senate and passed by the House separately, but it's still sitting in subcommittee until they can figure out how to reconcile the two bills. And finally, there's been a lot of talk about this fellow, DJ Girl Talk, and what he's been doing and what that might mean for the legal aspects of what he's doing. And I promise you I'll tell you what he's doing when we get to that topic. So first off, Pro-IP Act of 2008 stands for Prioritizing Resources and Organization for Intellectual Property Act of 2008. Sometimes I think they spend half of the time legislating the actual acronym and coming up with something that kind of silly that way, but there we are. Apparently the hyphen stands for four. So they passed this in 2008. The long and short of it is that Congress thought it would be appropriate to sort of address the situation that in the United States, intellectual property is becoming perhaps our leading exporting product of sorts, that we are a country of ideas, and we like to export those ideas, and perhaps we ought to have some additional ways in which we can help our citizens protect this intellectual property with respect to the rest of the world. Now, they didn't go too far overboard on a lot of these different things, but that was the general impetus behind passing this legislation. And one of the things they did here was easing the requirements for copyright registration, that by and large, sometimes copyrights, when registered, would get kicked out of the system because somebody spelled something wrong, or they didn't put their zip code down, or any of these silly requirements that would essentially kick their registration right back out, and all of a sudden you're not registered when you actually thought you were. And since copyright registration is something that people don't generally hire attorneys to do, once they file it, once they send it in, they just assume that it's taken care of and done and don't bother checking anything more, or perhaps don't know enough to know that they didn't get it done right in the first place. And that's nothing to say about people. It's just the nature of sometimes what can amount to silly bureaucracy. That if you didn't put your zip code in, does that really ruin your copyright registration? Well, they kind of took that out so that if your intent was there, you get a copyright as the date you registered it. And then they'll ask you to sort of fix some errors after the fact. Another thing they did here was the creation of a cabinet-level IP czar. They didn't put the words IP czar in there, but that's what media likes to do with the drug czar, home housing czar, homeless czar. This is the IP czar. And this cabinet-level position person is responsible for overseeing any number of ways that we can continue to protect intellectual property of U.S. companies and U.S. citizens. Don't know what that might do or not do yet. Nobody's really figured it out, but hey, if you're going to expand government, let's have an IP czar.
Is it considered a secretary position? Is it secretary?
I don't know if it's secretary level. It's part of the, so far as the language says, it's part of the cabinet. If that means it's a secretary, I guess I can't speak to that.
Do we know who that is?
I used to. When I looked it up a couple days ago. No, I... It's such an... at this point in time, literally, it's so inconsequential because nobody knows what he's supposed to do either. So you're charged with having the government oversee things that the government oversees. Don't know. It's kind of been the subject of a little bit of criticism to say, well, yeah, what are his role? What is his role? What is he supposed to do? Why have we created a cabinet-level position and presumably an entire department underneath him when there's no clearly defined role as to what he's supposed to do? That's criticism.
And there's a very fragmented, you know, usage community and creator community who both are Americans who completely think the other side's wrong, and they wonder what direction is an IPs are going to fall in.
And that might change from administration to administration. In the end, I don't think that it'll be much different. I think it's just another person that probably still answers to the individual heads of the Copyright Office and the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Hard to say. I guess we'll find out what that really means, because this was passed October 2008, so we're 4 months into the reign of the IP czar.
Are those structurally at Justice? Are they structurally at the Justice Department?
Yeah, within the Justice Department. Another thing that they did with this is the doubling of statutory damages for trademark counterfeiting. This was essentially introduced to go after the importers of any number of just knockoff products. You're just straight knocking off the actual product itself. That you're not trying to create your own that looks a lot like this, or you're not trying to really compete in the marketplace. You're just absolutely ripping off somebody else's trademark work. Think of a Gucci bag in this case. That how many different Gucci bags are out there? Or what's the other one that I can't think of? French fellow. Anyway,
Louis Vuitton.
Those are the ones that I see most often. Or people say, "Look at my Louis Vuitton bag," and they say, "Is it real?" Well, I don't know. It could be real. It looks like one made in Hong Kong. That's where I think they got their plant, but I'm not sure. Anyway, this beefs up the damages clause just a little bit more. That if you come in and show that you're not just infringing on the trademark, trying to sell your own product, you're flat out passing your product off as another product. Well, then the statutory damages are now doubled. And I want to say that we're up into the $100,000 range per infringement.
Is Billy really going to do a number on the guy selling the Rolex watches in Central Park? Or is
that... You can do a number on them, but they don't have much to do a number on. I mean,
what was the statutory damages? Is it $25,000 enough?
I think so. It's not more than $100,000, even with doubling it.
Per incident, or just a flat rate?
Per incident, per product of sorts.
Is that going after the people infringing on it? I know Italy has a law where if you're buying it, you can be fined as a buyer.
They don't have that here. I didn't know that existed in Italy.
It was
like 10,000 really euros
to buy a fake watch or fake bag.
How would you know? I guess you probably would know that you're not spending more than $10 on your Louis Vuitton bag to give you a clue. But I think that would be really hard to enforce, that in the end you could say, I don't know, maybe it was a garage sale item. At least that would be the defense on the buyer's side. I think that's really hard to enforce, hence the reason they haven't really tried here. One of the other things that Pro-IP Act did was the expansion of government powers to seize equipment. This was a bit controversial. People kind of picked up on this, that essentially, if you're considered a person who is downloading music or providing the ability for others to download music from you, the government can probably seize your equipment and consider you that sort of copyright infringer of sorts. There are a number of hoops to jump through with this, and nobody knows quite how they're going to play out. It's all steeped in some of this interesting legislative language that nobody quite knows what that's going to play out in courts. Things like if the substantial primary use of equipment is for illegal copyright purposes or something to that effect. Don't know. 4 months old, I guess, what remains to be seen what they can and cannot do with the language that they've created for themselves.
Has the
RIAA
taken any action under this,
this
new
law? The RIAA was one of the primary constituents pushing this legislation. There was quite a few others, but the RIAA was definitely behind this and was happy about its passage. It lost a lot of teeth. I don't think the RIAA got as much as they wanted to out of it. They wanted to see additional damages, like a raising of the statutory damages kinds of things for copyright infringement in and of itself. But therein lies the legislation fights that exist and where they kind of came down.
Well, it's the idea that if somebody alleges that you're infringing, that's enough, they can seize your equipment.
No.
I didn't think so. So what would be the...
Well, no. RIAA did the seizure on that. I don't remember the lady's name that they've gone round and round and round with, where they actually hacked into her equipment and saw some files on it that you could download, but she didn't even know were there, and she wasn't set to do any downloads, and they seized her equipment and tried to hold her out for copyright infringement, theft of property, etc., etc. So, I mean, number four looks like a perfect RIAA grab.
Sure. And I'm sure that's what they were kind of going for here, but to the extent that they can be used, I don't know if it's any different than other powers that are granted to FBI agencies of sorts right now. From my understanding, it's a slight expansion of their ability to do things, but I also think it's the sort of legislation that opponents of the whole idea would seize upon to say, look at what the government is now able to do, when in fact they likely had some of these powers to begin with.
So when we, I'm so old school in the sense that we're talking about, usually at least, some form of recorded music. Is that the idea?
This is one of the ways that it can be interpreted.
Yes.
Now, take it to another level. If somebody finds a counterfeiting machine for money, that can be seized. Well, there's a good idea. It's just a matter of how you're going to interpret what is actually in the legislative language. And some interpretations say that this could be interpreted to take away Grandma's computer because she's got four MP3s on there and an internet connection.
Yeah.
Or handbag sewing machine.
Doubtful. I mean, really, can you really support that argument as the FBI to say Grandma with four MPEs or a sewing machine needs to have that removed because it's in such strong danger of infringing on others' copyrights? Probably not.
But at some point, you go to somebody who's got 5 terabytes of stuff they don't own. Like, dude, it's time to shut your server down.
Yeah, and that's kind of what the part of it is, too, that for the bedroom Napster creator, that there exists another problem of just flat-out flying in the face of what is copyright law.
Right.
And they have no bones about it. They're saying they're doing it. Say, come take as much as you want from my server. Well, then the government might have an interest in taking the server from them in an effort to protect the intellectual property underlying. So, here is the kinds of things that I was just talking about, where the RIAA and various other groups here were supporting it for the most part, that the reasoning behind this IP Act was to protect the intellectual property of the United States, that by and large we're the leading producer in the world of intellectual property, and it's becoming, if not already has become, the leading export. I think I saw just a few years back an interesting statistic that if we're able to recapture the value of just recorded music and recorded movies that were illegally produced in just Russia and China, if we were to get that back into the United States, the value of that, we would balance the federal trade deficit, which is huge. We're always talking about this the trade deficit amongst other nations, that we're a nation of importers far more than we used to be, and we don't export anything like cars anymore, but perhaps it's just that we're not getting paid for what we export, and the true value of what we are exporting isn't being brought back into the United States in the traditional forms that we expect them to.
And that's probably calculated based on retail values of, like, the DVDs, as compared to being sold for a quarter on the corner in China or Russia.
Yeah. I mean, if you assume that, it's hard to say that could the people in Russia who are buying 25-cent DVDs, would they ever pay more than that for them? There's certainly some arguments to be made what that figure is, but the fact of the matter is it's still a substantial number.
AA has never known what the figure is. It's been a mock-up for decades.
Sure, but it still has
value. They marked it, I think it was $200 million until when 15 years ago or something, some senator said, hey, that's kind of an interesting figure. You know, is that the same figure you brought in last year, the year before, or the year before that? So why don't you guys go back and figure something out? They came back about a year later and said, hey, it's $2 billion. It's a, you know, scam, yes. The other thing is that the theoretical losses are, you know, based on countries that don't have copyright protection. You know, China is the one that had been beating over the head because China was the biggest market for the stuff. So they're trying to get China to now clean its act up and provide copyright protection a la like the United States. But, you know, what's to say is, you know, if you can't get a country, Russia, whoever, you know, to have copyright protection, then it's a loss of income.
Right.
You know,
it's, well, it's even assume
you can point anything you want at it, but you know, it's
assume for a moment that even the break point for people purchasing in Russia and China is a quarter. It's still absolutely none of that transaction is coming back to the underlying owner of the copyright.
But that's a gamble you take in putting something out there. That especially, you know, the expectation goes a worldwide. Secondly, there are places in the world that, you know, don't have copyright protection. And so your choice is either A, you don't sell into those countries, or B, you know, you very much restrict your market to where you can make a profit.
Sure.
You know, but you can't sit and cry about it because, you know, unless you happen to own the country.
But so but the fact does remain.
Yes.
But I mean,
they don't have
copyright protection.
Sorry?
They don't have copyright protection, or they don't enforce
it? They just don't enforce it.
That's what I thought.
They're parties to international agreements that say their national copyright law is going to meet a certain threshold.
That's what I thought.
But they don't necessarily enforce that.
Yeah.
So,
two
different things.
Well, China never did. It's only in the recent last number of years China actually implemented some sort of copyright protection.
Right, but
one of the largest, I mean, markets on the thing. I've seen it misused where, you know, a product that is legitimately sold by major companies here in the United States into other countries comes back here in the United States and they scream it's an invalid product because it's sold a lot cheaper there than they sell it here, and for them they're not making much money. So they will do everything they can to stop it as a copyright violation.
So the company is selling
Microsoft for one.
Microsoft sells their software to somebody in China.
Microsoft sells their software in Japan for far less than we sell it here. We're practically subsidizing it. So like an office of, let's say, a copy of Office 2003 in Japan, they put it into a cardboard, legitimate Microsoft-produced cardboard sleeve and sell the thing off for a few dollars a pop over there in Japan in mass.
That's what Microsoft chooses to do.
Yes, and then they bring, when it shows up back here in the States, because somebody buys it here and brings it back in, they prosecute the guy here in the States for copyright infringement because it's not a legitimate U.S. copy, of which the price is something like 30 times the, or 40 times the price that they were happy to get in Japan.
I suppose you make the same argument at Safeco Field when you try to bring in your own Pepsi when they've got $7 Pepsis there too. I mean, it's all about location.
Yeah, well,
and what they're really selling is a license. They're not selling the software. They're selling a license to use that software.
Right, but the license is legit in another country. Then there's no, if you look at some of the license agreements, there are no country restrictions on it.
In that case, I bet there are.
No, I've got one of the Japanese copies. So it's completely...
Then Microsoft must not be
it's
a very intelligent company.
But it's not perfect.
They may have a claim against their Japanese distributor if they're...
Yeah, I mean...
No, it's I find it very interesting. Yeah, I ended up buying one. I found it very, very interesting. It's in English. It's got hard-coded serial numbers on the stuff. There's no holographs on it. The license agreement is very strict and straightforward. It doesn't list by country. It gives you the rights to use it, blah, blah, blah. Similar, you know, non-restrictive, et cetera, et cetera. Except they get torqued off when it showed up back here because the cost over there is legitimately $5. The cost over here is $400.
There we are.
I say just a side point.
Opponents. of the bill argue there's little nothing to protect the property rights in this bill, that some of these different copyright owners can go after quote-unquote infringers that may be liable for penalties when these are some of the arguments where essentially they are the unknowing infringers of sorts, the grandmothers with four MP3s on the computer and an internet connection of sorts, that I think that these are always concerns that the government could be just too all-powerful and do whatever they want to, whenever they want to. Those are things to be concerned about just the same. I think it's a difficult position to strike a balance between allowing a bit of freedom of some of this fair use of different copyrights, like sharing amongst friends or what have you, or making a mixtape, or doing any number of things that would allow you to make a copy for fun or for local use or mashups or any number of things like that, versus the other direction, which is to say I'm trying to earn a living off of somebody else's underlying copyrights without paying for those, or essentially use without permission in order to further my own career and my own livelihood. That's always a question for the courts, and that's probably where it'll always end up, is what are the actual facts of this particular situation? And I think it's very difficult to come up with legislation that can, from a very top-level point of view, always distinguish between right and wrong on things like this that can have so many different facts underlying. So that is the Pro-IP Act of 2008, 4 months old. We may see what happens with that soon.
Actually, I have a question. I know one version of the bill there was going to direct the Department of Justice to sort of go after infringers on behalf of the copyright owners. I think I read something like that. Do you know if that got passed, sort of directing them to do more?
I don't think so.
Okay. Or I know there was objection to that from the Department of Justice.
Yeah, I don't think that was the case, that all copyright owners still have the same bundle of rights that they always have had, and it's up to them to enforce them.
Is the ISP, are ISPs involved in this particular?
No.
The
ISPs are still just as exempt from any number of infringing activities that may be going on while they're providing services, as they always have been.
Didn't they enter into some sort of agreement with the RIAA recently to terminate service to copyright infringers?
They may have, but that's just an agreement between two private companies.
Okay.
The counterbalance to that is don't use that ISP, which is sometimes hard if it's the only one that's servicing you, but that's the counterbalance, that if enough people clamor and say, I don't want you sharing my private information, and I'm going to use Clearwire or I'm going to use something else, customer is king. And if people move away from that sort of situation, it'll be quite obvious to an ISP that they shouldn't have chosen to enter that agreement. I don't think that's the case. I think, by and large, most people are not that concerned about it, saying, you know, I'm generally not a person that is in danger of having my equipment seized or that sort of thing. All right. Orphan Works Act is the second topic here. This is also one that's probably been subject to a lot of different controversy. And quite frankly, I think a lot of misinformation. I was really surprised to see the number of different arguments out on the web when I just did a Google search for pros and cons of this. I'm glad we have a chance to talk about it here, because maybe we can clear some things up, at least amongst this room. The concept here of what an orphan work is technically we can define it as something that somebody created that somebody else wants to use but can't find that creator. That, in other words, a movie producer wants to use some footage or a backdrop picture or some art in the back or whatever they want to use to create something else or something new or something different, and they can't find the person who actually created this or snapped the picture or put together the collage or created the artwork. And it's kind of hard to search on who owns these sorts of things because there's really no clearinghouse or database, much like we have in the music industry, in, say, ASCAP and BMI, where it's very easy to find out who the copyright owner is and who was the producer on that, and any number of ways that we can make sure that we contact the underlying rights owner so that we can ask permission and come to some licensing agreement on using that. So there are, it really comes into play in a lot of the graphic and visual artist areas, and especially in pictures, when newspapers are putting pictures out or when television shows are just on the fly putting together a report and they come across the right picture that they need or some footage that really drives home their point. It's just quick, let's go, let's get it out there. We can't find the right person. Let's just put it out there. And all of a sudden, the owner says, that's my picture. Then they have, all of a sudden, a copyright infringement lawsuit right there. And these different companies are, well, they're on the hook for that. And that can be problematic. So you've kind of, on the one hand, you've got the company side of this saying, well, we'd like at least a bit of a safe harbor or something like that. We're trying to do the right thing, and we're trying to find these people in order to ask their permission or come to some licensing agreement to use their IP, but we can't find them. It's very hard to find them. And if we do use it, you know, we'd hate to think that we could have come to a $500 agreement only to find ourselves on the hook for $150,000 of damages in a lawsuit just because we couldn't locate this person. So that's the principle behind what this is, and I think in theory that's a pretty good idea, but, well, let's explore this a little bit more. This isn't what it means. I was just kind of brainstorming what could be a possible acronym for this. I came up with another one. It doesn't have an acronym. It's just the Orphan Works Act. So. Anyway, as I was saying, the problem trying to be solved here arises from the fact that copyright protections exist without any requirement for registration. In 1978, when the 1976 Copyright Act went into effect, it took away the requirement that you have to register your copyrights in order to have protections in your bundle of rights granted to you. That in essence, as soon as something copyrightable was created, which is to say pen to paper or audio to tape or audio to disc, at that very moment in time, when it's fixed to a tangible medium, the bundle of rights for the copyright exists and it attaches. So before this, it was quite easy for companies that wanted to use different works that were out there to go and search the patent or the copyright office. And if it was there, they knew that they had to secure the rights. If it wasn't there, well, there were no rights that attached before that. So it was essentially part of the public domain. But in 1978, they changed that such that at that very moment in time, your rights exist. Therefore, if somebody else is using your copyrighted work without permission, that's infringement. So we've got kind of this situation where something that was working prior to 1978 for a lot of these companies, and it worked for the companies because they could just pretty much have free reign, because a lot of photographers and people who created visual works didn't have the means to go out and actually copyright every single one of these at $30, $35 a pop. And it was just, you figure that as a photographer, and especially in today's day and age with digital photography, you're going to snap 500 pictures in hopes of getting three or four that are good. But what if those six or seven beyond that that are kind of good get used and you didn't register them? Well, that's problematic. Nevertheless, you've got rights to everything you create. So all 500 pictures are just, the rights exist. So companies that typically use these things, and they're mainly news shows and newspapers and people that are putting together quick newsworthy items, let's use them once, let's get them out there, it's done, it's over with, don't have to worry about it ever again, would often just do it. And then they found themselves subject to some copyright lawsuits all of a sudden that was far more than they ever expected to kind of get in hot water over. So they start clamoring for this safe harbor type of situation where if you use this work, you want to kind of be in this position where, look, I did a diligent search of sorts and I tried to legitimately find the owner of the copyright so we could come to some terms. It's so hard to find these people because there's no real database or registry of sorts where we can identify pictures. If you've ever gone to the copyright office and say, I'm looking for this picture of the Capitol building, there's probably 752,000 different pictures of the Capitol building, all titled Picture of Capitol. Are you going to dig through and find the one that you've got? Probably not. And that's hard to do. So if this safe harbor is granted to them, the copyright holder can come forward after use and say, well, that's mine. And at that point, traditional copyright and contract law control the relationship between the two, meaning that the copyright owner at that point can say, I don't want you to use this any further, and that can exist. They're also entitled at that point to a reasonable royalty for the previous use that had already happened. What is reasonable royalty? It's probably whatever existed beforehand, that had they been contacted, they said, here's $500 for the picture and we want to be able to put it in, and that's what we pay all of our outside photographers for works that we put into our works. And there's probably a lot of evidence and intrinsic different evidence that you can bring forward to say these are the deals that existed before and this is reasonable for what we're doing. And $500 is certainly not $150,000 of copyright damages.
Are they required to escrow any money?
By that you mean put away some time, just in case?
Every time. Every time they do an act, that they do a search, can't find the owner, so they have to put, you know, the regular fee aside so that they actually can prove that was their intent and there's money set aside to pay whenever somebody comes forward.
I've never heard that. I mean, it could be part of it. I would think, though, that for the amount of money we're talking about, I just don't know. Because if you, in theory, you have to put it away in escrow then until the copyright could expire, which means let's assume that the oldest person in the world is 110 years old, plus 75 years after their death, let's put $500 for every time we do this away in an escrow for the next 185 years. That probably doesn't work for what they're doing. And I think we just assume that if they can't pay their reasonable royalty, then other remedies present, which is to say you just take them to civil court and say, you owe me the reasonable royalty and you can't pay it, so here we are.
Well, now, what if the copyright owner isn't contacted, somebody uses their stuff, but had they been contacted, the copyright owner could have said, no, I don't want you to use it, you are disallowed. But anyway, they whatever the reasons, they don't contact him, they do use it. Does that set a precedent? Is there any concerns about precedent if he accepts $500 or $10,000 or whatever it may be?
At that point, he also has the right to enjoin them from future use, which is to say,
yes,
it's out there now, take it out. I don't want it there. You have to remove it. I'm enforcing my rights. And that's a remedy that's always been available. They still have that anyway. You can always do that.
Isn't there a two-step penalty? If somebody ends up with something that's copyrighted but they're not aware of the fact that it's copyrighted and the copyright owner contacts them or sues them, there's a max, I think, of $25,000 or $30,000 per incident that they have, that's all they can get because they didn't know it was, you know, let's say, for example, they buy a piece of software from someone who says it's theirs. It turns out to be stolen. The people that bought that software on the good faith basis that the person they bought it from was the owner, that's the max, but the guy that actually did the stealing ends up with the huge truck of fines. There's that type of protection in it right now.
I don't know if that has any bearing on the Orphan Works Act. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's more of a, in this respect, if you knew the car was stolen or if you knew that the DVD player was stolen, I think it all comes down to the purchaser's knowledge. If you can
say, the way I read it is, I got a software issue going on. Is that the people who buy the software, for example, don't know that it's stolen?
Right.
That it's a derivative work that's off of something that the producer had no license to do it with. That there is a maximum fine of, I think it's $30,000 for each of the...
For the people that did the purchasing?
For the people that purchased it but didn't know it. It's not.
No, I mean, I don't even think you can get them on the hook at all.
No, I think it's written that way.
No.
If they didn't have knowledge that it was a stolen piece and they bought it in good faith, then it's that out there. If you can prove it's yours. The guy that did the work or whoever stole the thing is the one that purchased on the hook for the full copyright in each incident of sale and such.
Now, I think at that point, that's your defense then, is to say, I bought it from here. Why wouldn't it have the license attached? How could I have possibly known that this was stolen software? How could I have possibly known it was a stolen vehicle? I mean, it's when it comes down to it, property is property.
Yeah,
and we're not going to make a distinction between whether it's intellectual
they use that
or not.
On a stolen vehicle, when you say, how did I know? You know, I don't have any idea it was a stolen vehicle. They see the vehicle.
Well, I mean, then I'd bring in other evidence and say there was a dead guy in the back and there was guns in this trunk.
I mean, somebody steals a car, sells it to someone else, you know, the cops find the car, take it back, you know, whatever, whatever, and say, you know, the guy says, well, I didn't know it was stolen. Turns out he didn't know it was stolen, but he still loses the money he paid the guy that stole the car.
Absolutely.
Right, so I guess...
So it's a buyer beware setup, but I'm saying it's, they still lose the cash out. They're still the no...
Right, but I don't think should we carve out special instance for software? I mean, property's
property.
Using
automobiles, I'm saying in that aspect of it, they seize the automobile and then they see, you know, they lose the usage of what they just paid for, and they don't get their money back.
Right, but that is the way the world is, right? By and large, if you buy stolen property, even if you don't know about it, it does get seized back. I mean, if I picked up a Picasso for 35 cents, I'd say good for me, but I'm sure that the original owner isn't going to let me keep it just because I'm out 35 cents or even $35,000 in certain cases. It has always been and always will continue to be a buyer beware situation, and I think that the software industry should be no exception. Anyway, I think that's the legal answer, is there is no exception. There is no difference between any of the different industries. One of the other things that they create here with the Orphan Works Act is a database. And this is kind of an interesting thing that doesn't exist now, that they would create a visual works database of sorts, and perhaps a better way to search for images, and in a way for owners of visual works to be able to essentially offer what they do for sale. And here's a quick clearinghouse to go to and say, I need a picture of the Capitol building for what I'm doing, and here's a bunch of them that are available already in a database, much like what the Harry Fox Agency already does for the music industry. I think that could be a really positive step forward, and let's get a lot of creativity moving between different artists of different genres.
Google Images is really close to that right now.
And it's even without the government's help, somehow industry is taking care of that need. So, for that matter, Google is one of the backers of this legislation.
Well, Kevin, if a guy records something in a studio and he doesn't get a copyright on it, is that considered an orphan work?
No. Orphan work, the title, it's not as though some work transitions into being an orphan. It's just simply a way to identify the fact that somebody is trying to find the owner and can't. Once they find the owner, it's no longer an orphan, so to say.
What kind of proof are they going to have to present to prove that they've actually made attempts to locate the...
The legislative language is that they have to have a documented and detailed search.
So that could mean anything.
A Google search and then just, like, I don't know.
You can print it out.
There are a number of other... if it's any... to use an analogy to something else in the patent law, one of the things I'm dealing with right now is to find an inventor. I need him to sign something because the company wants to expand the rights of the underlying patent beyond the date that we actually got the patent. We can't find him, but we're allowed to sign on his behalf after a detailed and documented search for him. So we've sent a certified letter to his last known address. We've contacted human resources of the company to ask where they've been sending any of his remaining mail. I've contacted a person by his name on Facebook. It wasn't him. We've done a search under these search terms on Google, and we've contacted all of his other inventors, co-inventors on that. And that, in some opinions of my counterparts at work, doesn't yet get there. It's hard to say. Those are the words they use, so what is a detailed and documented search? That kind of remains to be seen as well. But clearly you can't just type in a Google name and see what you get. That one of the things would be to go to this database and see what's there. There's a couple of others that would all be linked together, different databases of photographs that exist. Suffice it to say, I think that if somebody wants to be found and tied to their work in today's day and age, it can happen pretty easily. Not everybody perhaps is internet savvy. Not everybody is has the technology means to be internet savvy of sorts. But it remains to be seen. Opponents of the Orphan Works Act generally are photographers, groups, lots and lots and lots of artists, National Writers Union. I was really amazed to see the number of different websites that exist. When you do I did a search for supporters of, and I found a couple pages that had that paragraph. And then I did a search for opponents of, and really the top 100 seemed to be individual websites that were just opposed to the Orphan Works Act on behalf of artists. So clearly the artistic community seems to be against this sort of thing. And from what I saw and what my opinion is, I think somewhat sort of the unfounded fear that this is a way to just steal copyrights. And I don't believe that to be the case.
Well, Google has a major legal effort to try to undo copyrights. There's rumors of up to $500 million a year in legal fees that they're spending pushing for legislation in every area that will limit penalties and do away with copyrights as soon as possible. That it's in their interest to not pay royalties, period. And they're going and making deals like with the publishers, $160 million here, they're capping their losses here for orphans, and they're just working their way down so that these $150,000 liabilities per hit don't exist anymore. And they're working towards just eliminating copyrights in general.
I don't doubt that they might be. It's certainly in their interest. I mean, they're in the interest. They're in the business of organizing information.
Right.
And underlying all information is some kind of copyright.
Right, and they're in the position of advertising the result and bypassing all the advertising to the deep link to get the content.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, do you see any connection between Google, which owns YouTube, and the enormous number of videos that are posted there, and somebody maybe wanting to take that, they not wanting to have to pay, they just wanting to have it.
Well, certainly.
I mean, who owns what, that kind of thing?
Well, there's a big case pending right now between Viacom, CBS,
yes,
and everything that CBS owns and YouTube, that any number of things that CBS felt was on YouTube that shouldn't be there, obviously they've got some sort of claim against them, that Google operates YouTube, and as an operator, you know that whether or not you've got licensed or unlicensed copyrighted material on your website, or you should know. In the case of Google and YouTube, you can't. That's going to be a hard thing to know. I think it stands to reason that if the music video produced by the artist is up on YouTube, maybe the artist didn't put it there, maybe they did. It's really hard to know. I mean, that's almost an unanswerable question. But clearly, that's what Google's interest here is, to try to figure out, all we're trying to do is present information to people. Are we trying to make money off of presenting information? And the answer to that is yes, they are, actually. Very much so. But is it extrinsic from the presentation? From a certain perspective, Google doesn't care what the underlying information is, so long as they can present it.
For free.
For free.
Without paying a royalty.
Yeah.
And there's a big lawsuit right now with Facebook, where Facebook's user agreement actually says, by uploading to Facebook, you transfer your ownership to Facebook. Several of the social networks.
I don't think there's a lawsuit on that, but there was an uproar.
Yeah, and so when they read the fine print, that means if you put your picture of your band's album cover on that website, you literally transferred the copyright to them.
That's not entirely accurate. The terms of use don't say quite that much, but they did just change their terms of use too.
But there's a few that are pretty egregious. A few of the early social network sites say anything you upload becomes the property of this site.
But that's kind of to protect them, too, to say that
exactly.
we don't want to have to get into this question later if you decide to sell your... If you enter a record deal and your album cover's up on there, and now Facebook gets sued by the record company,
right,
to say, well, no, look, our user agreement said that we owned it, so...
Right, but the people aren't reading the user agreement when they start uploading their music.
Sure.
In some of those cases, people are transferring the copyright of their song.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
That was the case with mp3.com a long time ago when they still existed. I think they still exist under Vivendi. And Vivendi still exists under something else. I think.
It's CNET.
It's probably, Google.
MP3.com.
Okay.
CBS Interactive about CNET.
These are going to be interesting topics to discuss amongst our panel.
What's the current state of this act?
Subcommittee. House passed a version. Senate passed a version. It's sitting in subcommittee waiting to be picked
reconciled.
Up. When that happens, I don't know. The entire Congress is very legislatively happy right now, so I think it could happen quickly and fast and without much debate. Hard to say.
They've also got a lot to work on.
Yeah.
Something that was interesting about this is that people got in touch with me who are artists and musicians who never, as far as I know, put up copyrights at all or even cared about it. Or these are exactly the type of people that couldn't be found. And then as soon as they find out about this, something can be taken from them. Then they're up in arms, which has been very interesting because they were never the type of people that would register in the first place. But now if someone tries to use their work, then, it's like the horse is out of the barn type of thing. It was remarkable.
I think I've used this expression to you before, too, that sometimes the best thing that can happen to an artist is somebody steals your work.
Yeah.
That was normally worth $500 is now worth a $150,000 lawsuit.
That's right. It's the story, this is from the panel coming up, but the concept is that piracy is not your problem, obscurity is your problem.
Mm-hmm. So, this may lead us into panel discussion, but I'll probably set the table for this first, and then we'll take ourselves a break. DJ Girl Talk, show of hands, who's familiar with DJ Girl Talk? Okay, I'll certainly talk about it in detail for others as well. This is an artist whose real name is Greg Gillis. He's a mashup artist. By mashup, he takes other copyrighted works and create something new from that. If he were a visual artist, he'd take collages from many other paintings and put them together in a papier-mâché of sorts. I think what he does is really interesting, and it is entertaining to listen to, because all of a sudden you're listening to the entire song and you're picking out different parts and pieces of all these different songs that we're all very familiar with. And in and of itself, it is an art form, and it's an entertaining piece of art form. But he's not asking permission for any single one of those. And he's taking snippets of 2 and 3 and 4 seconds each. Sometimes he's looping those. But when it comes right down to it, any copying whatsoever is just a copyright infringement if you don't either create it yourself and pay Harry Fox for something or secure the underlying rights through the sampling agreements type of situation.
Wasn't there some 3-second rule where if it's under 3 seconds, you can use it and over not?
High bar.
There was, I think that all came from some case that is no longer good law.
Yeah. That the original fair use interpretation, but it's been thrown away.
Yeah. That the interpretation of what is copying is any copying is copying, period.
Somebody got busted for a single sample. I literally sampled like 1/44,000th of a second that came from a different place. It was in a Nashville court about 2 or 3 years ago.
The original one was the Fifth Dimension's Up and Away one from the 60s, which cut it down to 5 bars. Yeah. Max 5 bars was free usage, and after that point, it became a copyright infringement.
Yeah, that's right.
You're saying we're down even a sample at this point?
At that time, I don't know.
There are lots of agreements that are out there between one party goes and brings forth the concept or the idea or the principle to another party to say, look, I'd like to use your work. And then the agreement that ensues after that is you can use up to 3 seconds. And sometimes that enters in, but that's just a licensing agreement to say I'm granting you the license to use 3 seconds of my song and no more. An example of that would have been when The Verve approached the Rolling Stones to use the beginning of their song Bittersweet Symphony. They were granted the right to use the first 8 bars. But no more. So they took the first 8 bars and looped it, and then looped it, and then looped it, and that violated the agreement, so now the Rolling Stones own that song as the settlement agreement to the lawsuit that was going to ensue. So this guy has a lawsuit waiting to happen. I mean, he's making no bones about it. He's saying he's taking it, and he almost, I think he wants to be the poster child for this, of sorts, to say, I am taking it. I am standing squarely behind what I call fair defense, or a fair use defense, that what I'm taking is inconsequential. And we've got case law out there that says, look, copying is copying. As little as 1/4400,000th of a second is copying, and that's the way the law is. And his position is, I can take a lot more than on that, because that particular snippet is my ability to use fair use. And we have other examples of this and other things that you can imagine, that if I'm writing a book and the three words get put together, he is at, well, he is at could probably be a phrase that exists in lots of other books. Did I infringe on their copyright because I used the three words he is at? No, and that's never been the case. But we are talking about different mediums here. And traditionally speaking, in this medium, the only reason that what Greg Gillis is doing is interesting is that we recognize what he has from other things. Otherwise, it wouldn't be interesting. If I took snippets of a book he is at and put it next to Jump the Tree and put it next to Penelope is Cruising, what would that doesn't mean anything, and it's not interesting. So, question?
At some point, you recognize the snippets of the work as being distinctive and being produced by a certain artist, as opposed to just language taken out of a dictionary and pasted together?
Almost sounds like it's a question about somewhat publicity rights of sorts, or trademark of sorts, that when something is so distinctive that you come to know that artist by that, like a Tom Waits voice. And Tom Waits has sued lots of people for trying to sound like him, and won. So is Bette Midler. That, by and large, people own their personality.
So you can actually sue someone for what is called pastiche, I guess?
Sorry?
You can sue someone for doing something in the style of...
If you can come to prove that people thought of the other underlying artist.
Well, I mean, for example, if I wrote a reggae song that sounded like Bob Marley, you know, the bad chance of that.
I'm sorry.
you see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In some of the case law that exists... one in particular, Bette Midler and Ford. Ford Motor Company approached Bette Midler to sing a jingle for selling cars. Didn't want to do that. That was back when it was bad for artists to be associated with anything on television advertising, before they realized you can make a lot of money doing that too. But nevertheless, at that time, she refused. She didn't want to be associated with that. That would be a bad career move. They hired somebody else to sound exactly like Bette Midler, and they put it out there.
Were they singing Bette Midler's song? Or
no, it was
an imitation.
Right. An imitation of...
Specifically
hired to sound like her.
And it did, yeah.
And they were enjoined from doing that through lawsuit based on the personality, the publicity rights that Bette Midler has. Now, those are some interesting circumstances where they said, we're trying to do this. Different circumstances mean different things. I know that Tom Waits, we don't know what some of these settlements could be. You never know what really happened when somebody gets sued by Tom Waits. Sometimes you just back away from that lawsuit. So he's been able to successfully stop others from trying to sound like him, but it could just be because they don't have enough money to fight him. Hard to say.
How concrete is the concept of fair use? Is it contested a lot?
It's always, there's four, it's kind of a four-part test of sorts that determines what is fair use, and I can't remember them offhand. Do you remember them offhand?
Yeah, it's a purpose and character of the use, which could mean a few things, the amount and substantiality of the portion used, the effect on the market for the work you're copying, one other one. I don't remember. The nature of the work you're copying. Like, is it a factual work or a creative work or something like that? And, and the way those play out in any given case, I mean, it can, you know, go lots of different ways.
Traditional concrete examples. It's great, but traditional concrete examples of fair use might be if you're doing a movie review and you have to reveal details about the movie because you're doing a movie review, that's fair use of some of the underlying story. If you're putting together a dissertation on the writings of William Shakespeare, assuming they were copyrighted, you could take snippets here and attribute and snippets here and attribute and snippets here and attribute and say, well, this is fair use. So maybe he can, in his work, every time one of those comes up, he just under the breath of what's going on saying, you too. Rolling Stones. Prince. As long as we attribute. Don't know. That could be somewhere where he's going with it that on... Well, you could do it in the liner notes, and then it'd be silly to put it up there in the actual work itself. But if he were to do something like that, that might be lending ourselves a little bit more toward fair use. And he might have an argument there. But in the end, I don't know if... is what he created interesting, but for the fact that everything he created from was already interesting.
My 15-year-old son has a video camera and a Mac. And so he's been working on putting together movies, and he's syncing music to it. And he actually posted something on YouTube that had 30 seconds of somebody, and within 5 minutes he got a notice that all audio had been stripped because of a copyright infringement.
Absolutely.
He's a 15-year-old kid. It's not like he's going to be publishing the material or anything. And not like he really has resources to jump through the hoops in order to synchronize music to a video while he learns how to produce creative content.
He can still produce it. I mean, you can sit at home and do it. When he put it on YouTube, that changes the character and nature of what he did. So he can still learn. He can still produce. He can probably put it on CDs and send it to his friends. He can email it to 100 other friends, and we're still not into the area where anybody would notice. YouTube is Google, and it's noticeable. So in an effort to protect everything, especially Google, Google being the provider of that content would be liable as a contributor of sorts to that copyright infringement if they didn't take it down. So that's they have to still continue to be a company that's paying attention to that and take it down, otherwise they're on the hook too. And in all things being equal, I'd rather sue Google than your son.
They had situations like this in the past with like bands playing covers in bars. And they did blanket negotiations where they said, we'll pay $100 a month all year to a Harry Fox type clearing agency.
ASCAP and BMI.
BMI, the club fee.
Yep.
It was commensurate with the size of the venue, and the fee was reasonable. And then that gave them a blanket license to not file per instance, per event. And so I think what's going to happen is they're going to do something like that, where you say, I'm producing material which is less substantial than, you know, big pieces. Let's do a Harry Fox deal or an ASCAP BMI deal. It grants me those rights for X dollars per year and settle. Mm-hmm. Because you can't leave it open and you can't prohibit it from happening. There's got to be some sort of settlement that's in concert with economic reality.
And isn't that where we're all striving to get? That we want artists to be paid, we want providers to be paid, and we want information and copyrighted material to be available.
Right.
That if all three of those things can meet in the middle, happiness is had.
Google has recently done a settlement kind of like that for their Google Books project with, and I don't remember the party, but like National Library Association or something like that.
It was $160 million to the Publishers Association.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's not going to cover everything, but it's going to cover a lot of works. And
a lot of derivative works.
Yeah.
That are created by assembling chapters.
And so, you know, the Publishers Association is going to have to figure out one way or another how the individual copyright holders are going to get paid from that, but... Mm-hmm. That's no longer Google's problem. That's their problem.
Are you protected by just not knowing that you're doing anything wrong?
No.
I try that every time I'm speeding. It does not work.
Well, is the major problem in this from either side simply the scope of it?
There's certainly that. That.
I mean, how, for instance, are you? Where are they going to file all this stuff if everybody registers everything? How, and how about the fees and how about the manpower? I mean, I could see that could be a rather large issue. The fact that there's so much stuff that isn't, at the Library of Congress or wherever, I see just the sheer scope of this as being troublesome.
Well, presumably, the people that want to use it and earn a living doing it will register. If you're not doing that, then you still have your rights, but you kind of got to go through the old channels to make them stop or come to agreements. Some of these new channels are just ways to take the lawyers out of it, which is always good because they make a lot of money. But not too much.
does this guy make money off of this? Or is he selling it?
Well, I downloaded it for free. Because he said to.
He sells out shows.
But he sells out his shows, and he's certainly famous now.
Okay. He has an option on his site to pay whatever you want, or you can take it for free.
Right. Okay. So I chose not to pay anything, since he didn't. Anyway, that's inside.
So are you a lawsuit waiting to happen then?
Because I downloaded that.
You downloaded copyright infringing material? So are you
absolutely.
Yeah, they could sue me for that.
They have to find you first.
They do have to find me. And every other person that did it. I mean, all things being equal, we probably all infringe on copyrights 72 times a day.
When you whistle.
Technically speaking, if somebody else hears you.
Yeah, you can't do it in the restaurants. Or the restaurant staff can't do it. That's why they do their own version.
Unless they get licensed by
us. If they have other music there, then it's all good.
But I, as an individual, can do that.
Depends on if it's a public performance.
Well, but I'm not charging.
And even still.
Even so.
As long as you don't give me a piece of cake.
I'm going to call that a good stopping point for us to take a break here, give away some prizes, talk amongst ourselves. We'll reconvene with the panel here and talk to everybody about these intriguing things.
And we usually have water and cookies, but the water guy is in Hawaii. And the cookies guy didn't show up. So.